Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Thank you for joining us for this Melbourne Writers Festival podcast. I'm Els Fitzgerald. I'm joined today by Delia Falconer and Bryony Doyle, who have each penned singular books bound by an exploration of what it means to be a woman, a mother, an artist in an era of ecological crisis. I'd like to acknowledge that we're recording this conversation on unceded sovereign land. I'm speaking on the lands of the Bunurong and the Bunwarung people, and I pay my respect to their elders past and present, and to the traditional custodians of the many nations that make up this country we live and work on. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. So, like many of you listening, I'm pretty concerned by climate change, what this means for us, how we can talk, think, and write about it. I'm really honoured to be speaking to these two brilliant writers for a discussion around motherhood in the time of the climate crisis. I'll introduce you to Delia and Bryony and ask them each to tell us a little bit about the books we'll be discussing today, and then we'll dive into a conversation. So Delia Falconer is the author of two novels, The Service of Clouds and The Lost Thoughts of Soldiers, and Sydney, a personal history of her hometown. Her most recent book is Signs and Wonders, a collection of essays exploring how global warming is changing not only our climate but our culture. Delia, would you tell us a little bit more about Signs and Wonders?
Yes, well, I'm coming to you from the unceded land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and my book, Signs and Wonders, is subtitled Dispatches from a Time of Beauty and Loss, and it's about how our feelings and even our culture are changing in the face of unravelling climate change, but also, you know, unravelling environment and destabilisation of the world around us.
Thank you so much. It's an amazing book. And Bryony Doyle's previous books are Adult Fantasy and The Island Will Sink. Her latest novel, Echolalia, an exploration of motherhood, capitalism and a family on the verge of disintegration. Bryony, could you talk a little bit more about the story of Echolalia? Because it's quite an interesting, complex narrative that you've created.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, Elsa. And I'm also on Gadigal land, but that's not where the story is set. So Echolalia is a novel about a family in a fictional regional Australian centre in Victoria. And it's set in the lead up to and 15 years after a terrible act of violence that occurs. But it also shows this community as it was in the recent past and as it is in the imagined future, just, you know, not too far in the future. And its protagonist, Emma, is a very young mother who kind of has stumbled into the good life. And a lot of the work of the novel is unpacking these kind of myths about what the good life is in Australia and this sort of simmering undercurrent of violence that and exclusion that can underpin these narratives.
Thanks so much for joining me today to talk about these books. I was going to say it was such a pleasure to read them, but it's not quite the right word, I don't think, because any work in this space is just, it's so challenging for me to read now. Everything around climate change and this kind of stuff feels so immediate and it's so overwhelming. I think you've both written beautiful and extraordinary books and that you've articulated feelings around the changing climate that I really connected to so strongly. We're talking about motherhood today, but also about family, legacy, environmental degradation, what it means to live through this age that we find ourselves in. In Australia, we've recently lived through these catastrophic fire seasons. In August this year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released their latest report, which was pretty devastating. And the UN Climate Change Conference is starting this weekend, and our government's plan is making headline news. So I wanted to start by asking you both, you know, how you feel about writing in this space. I know it's quite a big question, but you're both exploring such confronting issues and themes in your books, and you've captured some of the more uncomfortable aspects of what it is to live in Australia today. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how you came to write these books and what it's like for you to produce work in this space. I might start with you, Delia, if that's all right.
Obviously, it's been a fairly tough space to spend 1.5 years in. The hardest piece of my book to write was actually a fire diary about the 2019-20 fire season, even though, you know, my family had no close calls. You know, we lived in Sydney in this extraordinary, you know, smoke and this extraordinary sense of everything that was familiar being kind of, you know, almost blotted out around us, and even the air that you take for granted in Sydney being, you know, being no longer humid, no longer having its usual smells, incredibly disorientating and, you know, incredibly upsetting experience, see almost the whole of the eastern seaboard on fire. So it has been tough. How I came into writing the book was that I'm a great walker. I've actually just moved from the inner east to the inner west of Sydney, but in the inner east I would walk around the harbour a lot, and, you know, it's the privilege of working from home, and I would always sort of check what was going on in the, you know, the local sort of nature news, and one of the spots that I really like to sort of stop and have a little look is the harbour down in Woolloomooloo. And I was doing my usual routine, thinking, oh, just see what fish are in there today. And that day, which is a few years ago, I didn't see any. And usually I think, oh, well, it's a seasonal thing, and fish, you know, sometimes there are more in the harbour and sometimes not. I just had this moment of thinking, oh, maybe there are, you know, no fish to see. Maybe, you know, maybe things are really out of whack. And I realised I'd been feeling that a lot, and I realised that actually one thing I'd been doing in my walking, and there's lots of walking in this book, was, you know, kind of having a checklist to kind of almost keep the kind of vertical hold going on life in general. And, you know, on the state of the world. And so I just had this extraordinary walk where I found myself thinking, I look at these things and I don't know if what I'm seeing is just business as usual or if it's a sign of something, you know, something sort of terrible. And I thought, well, you know, in a way that almost brings us back to, you know, to all the sort of things that we used to, you know, not mock, but, you know, be a bit sort of indulgent about and find a bit amusing about the ancients with the way that they might, you know, sort of augurs might look at the insides of birds, or, you know, people, they would look at the movement of animals to sort of try and detect the future. And I thought, well, actually, we're really, in a way, as we're kind of confronting the unthinkable, the potentially unthinkable in every sort of daily moment, really we're in this moment where we're kind of, you know, really constantly in this kind of phase of not quite knowing if what we're looking at is a sign or a wonder. And, of course, what's going on around us is often very beautiful. So, you know, our phones are full of, you know, images of tardigrades or, you know, so various things that we're understanding more about the earth. But, you know, some of those phenomena, like, you know, sort of methane holes blowing like bottles of champagne, or patch marks appearing, you know, the remnants of old Neolithic villages appearing in earth that's so dry that their footprints are coming up. They're extraordinarily beautiful, but they're also really terrifying. And so it really came out of this one walk and sort of just having this moment of thinking, oh, what does this, you know, what do I mean when my brain sort of starts repeating this idea about signs and wonders?
Mm. That was actually something that I found so powerful in reading through your essays, that kind of tension between, you know, awe and unease and like the beauty and terror of, as you described, you know, sort of particularly in some of the essays you talk about how with the way we engage with media and this constant sort of cyclical nature of the social media we're consuming, that, yeah, you are kind of really confronted by things that seem marvelous but are also, yeah, quite terrifying in what they might mean and, yeah, how we sort of process that.
It was important because I didn't want to sort of conjure up some sort of pure world. I think we live in a mediated world where, you know, we are on our feeds, you know, certainly as a writer I'm probably on mine way more often than I should be, but, you know, we do live in this moment that can be extraordinary and can expand the world greatly through the knowledge that we can have about, you know, the wood wide web, the way that trees feed each other or look after each other, and you know, all these almost fairy tale like elements of how amazing the natural world is comes more amazing almost as we as it sort of, you know, slips from our grasp, you know. So I wanted to keep that kind of tension between beauty and terror constant in the book, but also to recognise that we don't live in a, you know, what we don't necessarily want to return to some sort of, or you know, not necessarily return to, but conjure up for ourselves is some sort of unpeopled wilderness that, you know, it's about thinking about really complex, you know, really complex relationships and issues.
Thank you. And Bryony, how is it for you? You know, this is sort of your second book about climate change. Maybe with The Island Will Sink, your first novel was much sort of more overt exploration of it. But definitely with Echolalia, it's very pervasive, this sort of mediation on this changing environment that your characters are living through. How do you find writing about this stuff?
Yeah, similar to Delia, it's not always the most comfortable place to be sitting and doing your writing and doing your imagining. However, I just find that it happens to be the most compelling space, and I also find that whatever else I'm imagining, these things assert themselves. Climate change asserts itself in my imagining of anything else. So it's not that I feel like, oh my God, I'm ethically compelled to write about climate change. It's that I don't feel like I can write about contemporary life and the psychology of contemporary people without considering climate change. It's kind of like, you know, when you read a book that doesn't include the internet, or, you know, a genre that isn't self-conscious of genre itself acts as though it didn't exist. To me, that kind of dissolves the form and becomes very naive. In Echolalia, I had this setting to begin with, which was this lake that all the rich families live around, and that it's a very prestigious address, and that it had dried up and become this paddock. And that was very much like the kind of central motif at when I started thinking about the book. But I didn't think that the book would be as much about climate change as it is. I was sort of out to write a domestic thriller. And then, you know, the conceit of having it moved 15 years into the future only happened after I started writing it. I was like, I really felt like you just can't escape this. And in fact, I guess that encompasses my feelings about writing about climate change, which is I can't escape it, nor should I want to escape it. Certainly there's points of respite, and those points of respite can be, as Delia pointed out, you know, moments of something being marvelous or to marvel at it, not necessarily like I'm deploying some kind of value judgment there, going like, oh, isn't this tremendous and marvelous, but rather like I'm marveling, like I'm in awe, and that's, you know, sometimes negative, sometimes positive, but just is kind of an experience, an emotional experience. And sometimes that respite is, you know, to hide your head under a cushion for a little while. But I find that you come out and you come back to the ideas. I find it very hard to think about who we are and what we're doing in the world now without thinking about the environment and how that makes us.
I've heard your book described as kind of Australian realist. I think even someone said disturbingly realist, which is a strange thing to say, but and I think it's true, that thing, you know, you can't really be writing contemporary fiction or creative nonfiction now if you're not engaging with climate change, because it's unavoidable now in the world we live in. And I was thinking about Jane Rawson, the Tasmanian writer, and, you know, sort of challenging this term cli-fi or climate fiction, and how often that can place the work that we write in this space as a kind of genre, when actually, you know, that's troubling because it pushes it into a space of being something that is not as real and as immediate. I think that, as you say, it's just sort of impossible to be working in this space without engaging with it, even if it isn't the sort of central or overt concern of the characters in the book. One of the things you sort of both touch on this a little bit, because one of the things that I've found most affecting in your work is, you know, you both write so beautifully on the line, and there's just prose and images in both of these works that they're so affecting, capturing this kind of horror and loss of the natural world. Delia, there's some lines, you know, in Signs and Wonders, how you write everything seems to have this terrible symbolic weight. And you were speaking earlier about, you know, watching the fish disappearing. What that cognitive dissonance of such disappearances can mean. Excuse me. I wondered can you talk a little bit more about that, this exploration of wonder, of the things that we're watching disappear and maybe that we shouldn't be?
Well, I think part of the problem is that, you know, we don't know always. I mean, we know the world's in trouble. We know that it's going past its tipping points, probably. But we don't have a set sort of time scale for it. So I think that, you know, what I wanted to capture was that sort of uncertainty. So not to just write a book that's a kind of reliquary or a lament, but what I wanted to capture was that constant sense of, you know, is it too late? Well, we don't know. Like Bryony, I can't not write about it. And the novelist, Indian American novelist Amitavh Ghosh, sort of says that our attempts to exclude, the increasingly unstable world and the climate out of fiction, but I would say also out of nonfiction, is a kind of derangement, that the madness sort of lies there. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, I was dubious about was, you know, there are plenty of books that tell us that, or you know, you can go to a conference with scientists who are fantastic, they're doing awesome work, but they'll say things like, if only we could, you know, appreciate how wonderful the Dunnet is, you know, we'd be able to, or this patch of grassland would be able to save it. And I you know, there are a lot of books on the market that tell, you know, sort of try to get us to wonder, but I kind of started to wonder if wonder was, you know, part of the problem in a way that, you know, perhaps thinking more, you know, I don't want to say more complexly or more ambivalently about these issues, to think about being a bit more, you know, a bit more real rather than, because when you wonder about something, sometimes you pluck it out of its context. And we do that, you know, our feeds do that. Our glamour photography does that, you know, that I think of that sort of image in, upmarket travel magazines where you see a little pile of saffron, you know, lovingly photographed, or, you know, a cilantro, you know, coriander in someone's hands at a market. And I kind of worry that sometimes some of the wondrous ways in which we write about, particular animals or particular parts of nature actually have a tendency to kind of anatomize, to take that thing and remove it from this context. And what, you know, what we're dealing with at the moment is, you know, is context, is a, you know, is a world that is accelerating in every possible sort of use we have of it, in, you know, so many different indicators like CO2 in the atmosphere, or, you know, the increase in methane in the atmosphere, and so on. There's about 24 key indicators. They're all, you know, going off scale, and everything is sort of not particular. You know, we've got to deal with that. That almost unthinkable sense of the fact that, you know, our with a predictable world, the world that, you know, we have grown up with, of seasons, of, you know, particular familiar things, is really on the verge. And so that wonder didn't seem to kind of quite encapsulate that particular problem for me.
Yeah, it's quite something I've been thinking about since reading both your books, and I wanted to ask you about this, Bryony, because I think sometimes when we're trying to engage with climate change or the climate crisis, which is, I think, a better term now, is that often we sort of lack the language to articulate or process the feeling of it. And, you know, I mentioned the IPCC report earlier, and I think for a lot of people it's really hard to kind of engage with the actual kind of real, the feeling of what this means for us, because a lot of the times the science is kind of inaccessible, or it just sort of lacks that emotion. And I think, you know, talking about imagery, some of the powerful images you've written into Echolalia, there's, you know, scenes where Emma, the central character, and her sister are, you know, talking about whether they've encountered a cane toad, which should never be where they are, and the disappearance of the birds that Emma remembers from her childhood. There's a line, I've written it down because I just think that's so amazing. You say, like, only the gulls and the Indian miners remain, and at the end of the world there'd be a gull to peck at the remains. It's just so good. Is that something you sort of think about when you're writing in this space of, you know, how fiction can kind of articulate this feeling and maybe sort of address some of this lack of language that we have to talk about it?
Yeah, so I guess, Echolalia, I do it in a very different way than I did it in Island Will Sink. In Echolalia, I wanted to have these characters who weren't overtly thinking about it so much, you know. There's not a moment where a character sits down to read an IPCC report and then, you know, tells us what they think. You know, it's not that kind of thing. So I wanted to capture that feeling of I was playing with horror tropes. I was playing with the idea of looking at a scene and trying to understand it. And that kind of like notion of something being ominous to one character, which to another character was just something that needs to get fixed up, you know, and kind of trying to get into the psyche of different kinds of Australians and how we are. And these are, you know, white middle-class Australians in regional Australias of our prominent family, and how they're kind of reading these signs, I suppose, Delia's signs, you know, as they walk about, as they continue with their property development company, as they extend their legacy, extend their family, how are they seeing the world, and how are they seeing the world that their descendants will move into, and how are they relating that to their past, a narrative of the past, which is in various different ways a denial of kind of colonial legacies and of various ways that privilege works. But I didn't want to say any, I wanted that to be a feeling and atmosphere in the text produced by the various characters. And that means being, yeah, very alert to what is in their immediate sight lines. And certainly I spent a lot of the town that Shorehaven is based on, I spent a lot of time just walking around and feeling the different ways that I feel when I'm in that town, and also remembering and imagining and thinking through the ways that other people that I had grown up with or that I have known since then describe things, and also thinking about the way things are described in the media, you know, that all of those things amass to create a feeling that is the psychology of experiencing and living through climate crisis.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about your central character, Emma. You know, she's the mother in this book, and the narrative really hinges around her experience of, you know, having children and kind of trying to raise them in this family, the Cormac family, who are this kind of dynasty, and come with this pressures of this legacy. She, Emma, I think there's a kind of troubling of this Australian rhetoric of the good family that you do in Echolalia, and Emma's kind of representing what can happen when the sort of pressure and expectation of conforming to this cultural idea of like what makes a good family, what's the right kind of life, particularly for a woman. There's a sort of unpacking of this kind of the myth of motherhood, I guess, that it's supposed to be amazing even when it's really hard. Reading this character, you know, she's obviously struggling extremely with mental health and postpartum depression and all kinds of things, which is sort of being ignored by the family that she finds herself within. Would you talk a little bit more about Emma and like the way you've constructed that character?
Yeah, so I guess importantly as well, just to add to what you were saying, is that Emma's not the only mother in the story. So she's kind of counterbalanced by Pat, and Pat's a real pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get on with it kind of mother of a different generation, and whose kind of self-identity kind of crumbles if she acknowledges all the things that are making life really hard for Emma, including her struggles with postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis at a certain point, and including the ways that Emma perceives the family being inflexible in a way that seems to erase her and at least one of her children. And this idea is the idea that begins to feed all the other kind of scary, bad, troubling ideas that occur to her. And it then, you know, is fed by her watching the lake in front of their, you know, beautiful McMansion with the, you know, big double glazed windows and whatnot, this beautiful lake that she stood in front of when she was pregnant and had all her photographs taken in silhouette and all of this kind of stuff, turning to a paddock that's dry and there's not very many birds around there and people are taking their four-wheel bikes out there and having a good old time. You know, so that she's perceiving a family that she's in the middle of making, a family that actually doesn't have the place that her relatives, especially her mother-in-law and her husband, are asserting that it does, that she actually feels like what she's doing is something quite damaging. And it's that thought that, pushes her to do something, and she does something terrible. She breaks and she does something terrible. But ultimately, what I was trying to do is very much trouble and play with the symbolic loading that we do onto motherhood. And I'm not talking about parenthood either here. I'm talking specifically about motherhood. I think that we load motherhood with so much symbolic capital that we kind of annihilate women in some ways there. And that goes from how we talk about when you should be having children, how you should feel about your children, how you should feel about your children's future. All of this stuff is a lot to bear in addition to just parenting, you know, just dealing with the work of looking after your children in the world as it is now and will be in the future. So, yeah, and I don't think that that's a specifically Australian myth either. I think that, you know, it occurs differently in different cultures, but motherhood is very symbolically loaded always.
Yeah, she's an incredible character, and, you know, I would love to talk a little bit more about the structure of the book, because just the way you've constructed her through the use of this kind of before and after section. But I'll just wanted to ask Delia, because something you mentioned then, Bryony, is, you know, about this. There's a question now, I think, particularly for mothers, around how you feel about bringing children into the world and raising them against this sort of at times catastrophic background of the climate crisis. You have written, Delia, so beautifully about your children, and there are scenes in there that I just think they're so heart-wrenching. Of, you know, your son asking about which animals are endangered now, and there's your daughter saying, "Is it true the world's going to die soon?" Which that made me cry. Can you talk a little bit more about, like, how do you kind of grapple with that as a mother?
Gosh, I think if I'd thought of it as actually approaching the book as a mother, I would, and you know, through the edifice of motherhood, I probably would have been choked and not been able to write it. So and I think that those questions of futurity, you know, affect the fathers as well. I mean, I think they're very specific things that affect mothers, but I think that bigger question of just, you know, how to think about your children's future is, you know, crosses across the sort of gender barrier. My main purpose was, I think that so much of this stuff is really almost unthinkable, and, you know, we are hit by those IPCC reports and so on. And I thought, well, actually, you know, I came to having children very late. I was 44 when I had my twins, so my 55 now. So my life kind of covers not all of the great acceleration, but that very much that sort of period, you know, from that sort of 1950 onwards, where our consumption just of everything just you know, sort of started to, you know, go up like a hockey stick stem and then the handle, and then sort of go off the chart. So my main aim as a, you know, nonfiction writer was, you know, to use my life as it is as a kind of measure to try and just be able to put so many of those sort of things and feelings that I think so many of us are experiencing into, you know, into my own experience and sort of body and you know, walking and, you know, being a mother and all those sort of things kind of come into the package. But of course, with having children, that you do have that sense of, you know, real extra urgency, because you know, you are not only measuring time from your own timeline, but you're measuring it from theirs. And I think that our knowledge really started to hit about 2015 of quite how bad things are. I had my children in 2011. So, you know, I didn't grapple with those questions of whether to have them. I grappled a lot, but not quite in the same ways I think we are now, where we're seeing all the tipping points and changes that we always thought in some distant future are actually now here. And so, you know, I think when I started writing this book, which has only been a period of, you know, 1.5 or 2 years, you know, we were in that period where we were told we had something like, you know, 12 years to turn things around before, you know, we went past our terrible tipping points. You know, then it's gone to 18 months. Now it's sort of now we're looking at the fact that, you know, we're sort of at present on, I think it's a 2.75 degree trajectory of heating if we keep things as we are. So that sense of measuring time through them and thinking, you know, what do you say to them? You know, they're still quite young. You know, my son, I think, is a more tuned into politics and some of these sort of issues than my daughter is at present. But you endlessly sort of grapple with, well, how honest to be? You know, what sort of skills should you be teaching them? all the sorts of things that you used to take for granted in your own life, you know, that you might go on and have a career or, move in the world in certain ways. It's really hard. It's really, really hard to imagine that those sort of pathways still exist for them. And that is, you know, what should you be teaching them? James Bradley writes in his piece on being a father and climate change, should I actually be teaching my kids how to, how to hunt and survive? I mean, you know, all those sorts of things come through your mind. So it's very, I think that sense of urgency is really increased, and that sense of wanting to do something, because, you know, I've always been invested in these questions, but, you know, of course it's more distressing and it's more urgent.
Mm. And I was thinking about it as I was sort of preparing to have this conversation with both of you, that there is a certain thing that I think for myself anyway, it feels like it's very difficult to engage with this question, this sort of topic of motherhood in the climate crisis without kind of acknowledging, you know, your own, my privileged position as sort of a white middle-class person, and that there is a lot of choice for me available as to whether or not you might want to have children. Something you talk about in one of your essays is, you know, the way that there is a problem with this term Anthropocene that we sort of use now, because it does imply that the responsibility for the time we find ourselves in is equally shared among all people. Would you just talk a little bit about that, Delia?
There are so many different terms that, you know, people have been trying to coin for the Anthropocene, some of which, you know, are going to sort of recognise, you know, in that sort of inequality. I think, you know, Anthropocene's the one that sort of somehow has captured the imagination. I think it's the one we're sort of stuck with. But, Capitalocene, Plantationocene, you know, there are a number of different ones that try to sort of recognise that. Development is, you know, and these developments are uneven, and, you know, certainly for many Indigenous people, you know, we're sort of in the, you know, the West, in inverted commas, you know, many of us are sort of saying, oh, look, you know, there's a potential apocalypse to come, and, you know, it's important to remember that, you know, that many of those cultures have already been through or are going through ongoing violence and, you know, the loss of the familiar and the homely. So, you know, the Anthropocene kind of packages this up, I guess, as a, you know, in a particular sort of way. But I've tried to be aware in the book, and I talk a bit about the different levels and the problems around using that particular term. At the same time, it's so, you know, tremendously handy, I suppose. But, you know, there are certainly, you know, we mustn't forget that there are certain parts of the world as well that are already experiencing some of the things that we see in our future in terms of sea rise and so on, in terms of the much of the migration to America at the moment is coming from Central America, where there is already such climate change that many of the people who are seeking a home in America now coming from there are coming from areas of climate change, as are many other refugees in the world as well. So, yeah, I've tried to kind of think broadly and keep turning that sort of question around in my book.
Yeah, I think you do it brilliantly. I'm conscious that we are going to come up on at the end of our time together soon, but Bryony, I mentioned before, you know, that you've used this structure in Echolalia where you flip between the before and the after, and part of what you do with that is that, you know, the book begins with this incredibly confronting scene, and so you sort of know from the beginning, I don't want to give anything away because I think people should definitely go and read it, but yeah, you set up this story that's kind of this exploration, not of, you know, of who's done, of committed this crime, but as to why this person has done it. And then, you know, sort of oscillating back and forth with the before and after, you're also showing these different experiences of the time that we're living in. And I think, you know, you've got incredible mediations on class in your book, and in some of the later sections, you know, you really see through Emma how she, I guess, is navigating this different world that she lives in. Was that structure something you always were drawn to, or
structure's I think structure is really important to me, particularly in, I mean, it's obviously important to any book, but particularly in thinking and writing through the psychology of climate change. And I'm struck by when I was reading Delia's essays about how your life structures it and how it allows us to kind of take in these changes in a way that feels organic and that makes connections that we might not necessarily make if that's not our timeline, our lifetime. When I thought about writing Echolalia, originally I wanted to do it like Deliverance. I don't know if you guys have read the book of Deliverance, how it's like one date, one date, one date. And I just thought it's not enough time. And it's that problem, right, of slow violence, that Rob Nixon concept, or, you know, how do we show the little tiny things that are changing. And this was not a sweeping novel, you know, I don't do the 50,000 years in the future kind of thing, but I just wanted to have, you know, enough time to kind of contrast, okay, particularly here are some of the sort of ideological claims that are made at the start of a decade, you know, the 2010s, and here they are, here are some of the things that we can actually see carry the ramifications of those claims. And also I did want to show, And I mean, I guess when I was writing it, this book, I started writing it in the end of 2017. So pre-fires and things like that, but not pre-bushfires, but pre that hellish summer. And I think, you know, I just wanted to show a kind of a sweeping period in which these things happen all the time and the characters understand that they continually happen all the time. And I was interested in that, a structure that allowed me to do that and allowed us to see the changes to the characters as well over, you know, not a huge amount of time, but enough time to challenge their own assumptions, to have grappled with terrible tragedy. You know, a 15-year period, lots of us grapple with a terrible tragedy in a 15-year period if we are adults, and what that does to the psyche and what that does to the way that we're thinking about the world around us and to our responsibility to each other.
I want to keep talking to you both. I just think I've got so many questions I'd love to ask you, but I think we should probably leave it there. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's a challenging space to be having these conversations in, but it's just, you're both so brilliant in the way you're exploring them. I highly recommend that everyone get your hands on a copy of these wonderful books, Signs and Wonders by Delia Falconer and Echolalia by Bryony Doyle. You can purchase copies from Melbourne Writers Festival's partner bookshop Readings online or in store now, which is great. Thank you, everyone, for listening in and supporting Melbourne Writers Festival. And thank you so much, Delia and Bryony, for chatting with me today.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.